welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. At just about 12:30 p.m. on November 22, 1963, shots were fired at the motorcade carrying President John F. Kennedy and others through the streets of Dallas. Texas radio station KLIF interrupted the broadcast of the Chiffons' rendition of I Have a Boyfriend with this.
This KLIF bulletin from Dallas, three shots reportedly were fired at the motorcade of President Kennedy today near the downtown section. KLIF News is checking out the report. We will have further reports. Stay tuned.
Soon the station would turn its broadcast entirely to what would unfold as the assassination of President Kennedy. A shocking and tragic story by any measure, but not altogether surprising to those who had warned the president to stay away that day. Bill Metaglio and Stephen Davis have written a book about the forces in play on that fateful day in Dallas. The name of the book is Dallas, 1963. Joining us by phone from Texas to talk about those days is co-author Stephen Davis. He is curator at the Whitliff Collections at Texas State University San Marcos and a leading scholar of Texas culture. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for having me. It's good to be here with you.
The book is about the city and the people who lived there. You called it the most promising right-wing citadel in America. Describe the Dallas of 1963.
Well, Dallas was a very conservative city at that time, and during the 1960 election, it actually gave Richard Nixon his largest majority vote of any city in the country. Nixon won Dallas by 2-1, so it was generally a conservative place. But what happened, it really kind of warped and twisted Dallas into the face of hatred in America, into the face of really extreme politics, is that you had a handful of very powerful men at the very top of the city. You had the publisher of the Dallas Morning News, the leading paper in the South. You had the wealthiest man in the world, H.L. Hunt, the oil billionaire. You had the leading spiritual advisor in the city, the Reverend W.A. Criswell, who led the First Baptist Church. And you had the city's congressman. And you had all these really powerful people come together in extremist opposition to John Kennedy, and they created a really very disturbing environment, really kind of unparalleled among any city in the country, and turned Dallas into a place that was notorious and was really, frankly, blamed by many people in America for having somehow killed Kennedy. And that's really the story that, you know, Bill Metaglio and I wanted to tell. To go back and see why so many people were warning John Kennedy to avoid Dallas that day, and why he told Jacqueline that morning as they were heading into Dallas, he said to her, well, we're heading into nut country today. And that's a story that's really kind of been lost in American history as people have focused on ballistics tests and conspiracy theories and those sorts of things. We've sort of gotten away from understanding these really kind of frenzied conditions that Kennedy was coming into when he arrived in Dallas.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Steve Davis. He is co-author of a new book. It's called Dallas 1963. The backstory to Dallas is fascinating. It was, in a way, all glittering skyscrapers, such as they were in the day. Progress appeared everywhere, including the fabulous Neiman Marcus. But there was another side of the city. If you were black, it was a truly scary and dangerous place. It was a stronghold of anti-segregationists.
Yes. You know, Dallas had at one time been the national headquarters for the Ku Klux Klan, and it was a city that you know, truthfully, was not unlike many cities in the South that enforced very strict segregation. The difference between places like Dallas and other cities is that in Dallas, you had a business community that was very tight-knit, that ran the city, essentially. And these people did everything they could, really, to forestall any progress on integration, while at the same time trying to tamp down any kind of, you know, public resistance in the forms of sit-ins and things of that sort, demonstrations. And so it became incredibly tense in Dallas, you know, because this really was right in the middle of the mass movement to integrate the United States, you know, 4 or 5 years after Brown v. Board. You know, I mentioned the Dallas Morning News, the publisher of that paper is a guy named Ted Dealey. You know, Dealey Plaza was named for his family. And Ted Dealey was really the mouthpiece of these people who were anti-civil rights and pro-segregation. His paper referred to the NAACP as the National Association for the Agitation of Colored People. and they were incredibly hostile to the idea of any progress on integration.
It was interesting because it was a prosperous city, and on one hand, the business community was leading the city in that direction and tamping down any agitators. On the other hand, they wanted to appear as modern and with it and a place that people should want to come to.
Exactly. And you mentioned Neiman Marcus, and
yeah.
This is really kind of one of the most fascinating things about Dallas at this time. When the 1960s began, the guy who owned and ran Neiman Marcus, Stanley Marcus, was really the most famous man from the city of Dallas. He was very well-connected all across the world. You know, he was friends with John Kennedy. He was friends with Dwight Eisenhower. He stayed over at the White House. He was friends with Prince Rainier and Princess Grace. He, you know, outfitted European royalty at certain occasions. He outfitted Princess Grace's wedding. And he published articles in Fortune, Atlantic, and all of this stuff. And he had this vision for Dallas, exactly what you say. It's a very cosmopolitan, international, sophisticated city. He brought Coco Chanel and brought Sophia Loren to Dallas. And his temple, Neiman Marcus, really became kind of sort of the expression of high culture in Dallas. You know, he had art exhibits in the store. And this vision that he had is this lovely, sophisticated place. Really was undercut in a couple of ways. One is that Neiman Marcus was itself segregated at this time. And you can see in Stanley Marcus's archives, that was just driving him crazy because he had been pressuring the other business leaders in Dallas to integrate for years, and they kept putting him off, basically. So he was a very conflicted man in that sense. And as the extremists began to take over the city and really just warp and destroy Dallas's image across the rest of the country, you know, you can see that it was breaking Stanley Marcus's heart, and he had a very difficult decision to make. You know, he was kind of a closet Democrat in Dallas,
mm-hmm.
and many of his best customers were very ardent conservative Republicans, and he knew that if he came out in public as Democrat, it would really undercut his business. And so those are some of the issues he was dealing with. And as these really kind of violent mob actions happened in Dallas, you know, Stanley Marcus was on the front lines of all of those.
He was also Jewish and discriminated against himself, excluded from the country clubs, excluded really from the society that he courted in his store.
Right, exactly. You know, Stanley Marcus was a member of the Dallas Citizens Council, the official group that helped run this, or basically did run the city of Dallas, a group of about 50 businessmen. And he was really quite respected in Dallas because he had made so much money, and he was something of a showman, and his store served such an important purpose because Dallas was basically reinventing itself, or actually inventing itself, as a place for northern corporations to relocate to the sunny south with hardly any taxes at all, no unions to speak of. And when these executives from the north would come down and see Dallas, you know, they would see the signs, you know, white drinking fountains and colored drinking fountains and these other kinds of really in-your-face examples of segregation. And the way that these people were placated is they would be taken to Neiman Marcus. And so Stanley's store served a very important purpose in basically showing people that, yes, we're segregated in Dallas, but look at what else the city has to offer. And so Neiman Marcus was a big selling point for the city.
With those mobs that you referred to, and I want to get to some of the particular mob experiences that occurred before Kennedy arrived that day, but why was Stanley Marcus at the forefront of those mobs? How did he find himself there if he felt the way he did?
Sure. And I'll tell you about, really, this is the most interesting one in many ways, because it helped define Dallas, and it came at a very critical time. Basically, John Kennedy and his running mate, Lyndon Johnson, were losing in Texas to Richard Nixon in the 1960 election, which became, as you know, one of the closest elections in U.S. history. Mm-hmm. Everybody knew the election was coming down to Illinois and to Texas, and Nixon was ahead by about 6 points in the opinion polls in Texas. And the Kennedy campaign dispatched LBJ back to Texas to do some last-minute campaigning just a few days before the election. And it was really, very difficult circumstances to head back into his own state, which should have been locked up long before. And the reason that Kennedy was doing poorly in Texas had to do with the Democrats had a very strong civil rights plank that year, the strongest in history done by any party, mm-hmm. and that really offended a lot of the Southern conservatives who were still nominal Democrats at that time. And also Kennedy's religion. Kennedy was a Catholic, and these attacks that many of your listeners, I'm sure, remember hearing about basically came from Dallas. I mentioned earlier the Reverend W.A. Criswell, leader of the First Baptist Church, the largest Baptist congregation in the country, rose in the pulpit and denounced Kennedy and said that if this Catholic man is elected president, it will mean the end of religious freedom in America. We will be on bended knee to the Pope in Rome.
And the he's the one that sort of started that whole...
Right. And mm-hmm. I should add, as long as I'm mentioning W.A. Criswell, mm-hmm. he was also a very vocal opponent of civil rights. Mm-hmm. He called those who wanted to integrate a bunch of dirty infidels dying from the neck up. And so, you know, this is the man where a lot of people in Dallas are getting their cues from. And one of Criswell's parishioners was the wealthiest man in the world, H.L. Hunt, the oil billionaire who actually had 200,000 copies of Criswell's sermon printed up and mailed out to other Protestant ministers across the country. And so the attacks on, you know, Kennedy's religion, the Southern conservatives refusing to endorse or support the ticket because of its stand on civil rights was really hurting JFK in Texas, which is why 4 days before the election, Lyndon Johnson and his wife Lady Bird arrived in Dallas, and LBJ was coming to speak at a luncheon at the fanciest hotel in the state, the Adolphus, and Stanley Marcus, who is a very quiet supporter of the Kennedy-Johnson campaign, and an old friend of Lyndon Johnson's, by the way. LBJ was, you know, one of Neiman Marcus's best customers. Mm-hmm. And he and Stanley were both kind of closet supporters of civil rights in Texas. And so Stanley quietly supported or sponsored this luncheon. And when Lyndon Johnson and Lady Bird showed up for this on the streets of downtown Dallas, they were met by what's become known to history as the Mink Coat Mob. This is a group of leading citizens organized by the city's congressman, Dallas Congressman Bruce Alger, who was already known as the most extreme member of Congress. He was the only person in Congress to vote against a program to provide free surplus milk at lunchtime for needy school children. And he never passed a single piece of legislation. He basically sponsored legislation to withdraw from the United Nations, to break off diplomatic relations with the Soviet Union, things like that. Mm-hmm. And Alger actually, at this protest, was holding a sign that said, LBJ sold out to Yankee socialists. And his backers were the wealthy elite in Dallas. And so he had this mob of people who were very well-dressed. Many of the women were wearing mink coats, and these are mink coats that Stanley Marcus actually had sold them himself at Neiman Marcus. And the mob became very ugly very quickly. There were about 300 people. They surrounded Lyndon and Lady Bird. They were spitting at them, cursing at them, trying to hit them with picket signs. People who were wearing Nixon pins were pulling the pins out and trying to stab Johnson supporters. People had, you know, broken noses, broken ribs, and they were sent to the hospital. It was just this terrible melee, and it was so surreal because it was, you know, these well-dressed leading citizens leading this kind of hysterical mob action against Lyndon and Lady Bird. And what happened in the middle of this riot is that LBJ, you know, 6'4", was kind of standing above the crowd, and he saw the television cameras rolling. And immediately his political instincts kicked in. He made all the cops get away from them, made all the bodyguards get away. He sheltered Lady Bird under his arm and basically went at it alone and assumed his most pious look of martyrdom. And Lyndon, one of his aides was a guy named Bill Moyers, who said later, you know, if Lyndon could have thought this up, he would have thought it up because he knew exactly how those images would play. And you know, and also, I should mention that Stanley Marcus had come out of Neiman Marcus to join Lyndon and Lady Bird for this lunch, and they were his best customers, just kind of going nuts, hysterical. And he had to walk in front of them to join Lyndon and Lady Bird, and he knew, as Lady Bird said later, Stanley Marcus lost a lot of his best customers that day. But what happened with the mob is once those images appeared on the evening news that night across the nation, it really aroused a huge backlash against these crazed Richard Nixon supporters in Dallas, Texas. And it basically caused, it made a lot of the Southern conservatives very angry to see a Southern woman treated in this way by this mob. And it made them go ahead. You had leading conservatives who at that point decided to go ahead and endorse the Kennedy-Johnson ticket because of this. And basically, it allowed Kennedy and Johnson to stage this kind of remarkable come-from-behind victory in Texas. They narrowly won the state by 46,000 votes. And Richard Nixon himself later blamed his loss in Texas on what happened in Dallas that day.
My guest is Steve Davis. He is the co-author of the book Dallas 1963. We'll continue our conversation when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Dallas radio station KLIF delivered the usual upbeat top 40 music chatter and a litany of ads for cars, beer, and Thanksgiving turkeys before turning its steady attention to some kind of ruckus downtown on November 22, 1963. As the minutes passed, the direction of the shots fired were narrowed to the convertible limousine, which carried President John F. Kennedy and others in a motorcade through downtown.
All available downtown units are converging at emergency speed to that area. The entire area has been blocked off. It is roped off now. No one allowed in or out as the search for this would-be presidential assassin continues in downtown Dallas. What had been a very smooth journey to Texas for the president and his wife and other officials, Vice President and Mrs. Lyndon Johnson, now has turned in to another black smear.
To another black smear. That is what Dallas faced as a community after the assassination of Kennedy. But the hatred of Kennedy and what he represented to an ultra-conservative swath of Dallas was well known long before that day. Joining us now is co-author of the new book, Dallas 1963, Stephen Davis. Let's go back to that reference of another black smear. Are they referring back, do you think, to the mink coat mob?
That certainly was the first black smear for Dallas. You had 3 years, really, of just increasing hatred and vitriol and kind of frenzied attack on political opponents who were defined not just as political opponents, but enemies of the state. And basically, this really culminated 1 month before John Kennedy arrived in Dallas. I mentioned Stanley Marcus earlier, the proprietor of Neiman Marcus, who had this vision for a sophisticated international Dallas. And he saw that the far extreme radical right was really destroying his city. It was turning it into this kind of place of hatred. And so he thought he'd come up with a good solution. A lot of these fervent anti-Kennedy people were believing and saying, and H.L. Hunt's radio program across the country was telling people that John F. Kennedy was going to surrender sovereignty of the United States to the United Nations. And so Stanley Marcus's idea was, I'll invite my friend Adlai Stevenson, who is our U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, to come to Dallas to give a talk to sort of explain to people here in a very rational and calm way that the U.N. poses no threat to the United States at all. And, of course, this turned out to be really one of the blackest days in Dallas history. Adlai Stevenson was greeted by a very angry mob. He was basically nearly killed on the streets of downtown Dallas. You know, he too, just like Lyndon Johnson and Lady Bird earlier, was spat upon. People were throwing punches at him. He was hit on the head with a picket sign, and his getaway car was rocked by the mob before it was able to speed away from the scene. And this is when Adlai Stevenson turned to Stanley Marcus and said, "My God, are these human beings or these animals?" And this, too, just like the mink coat mob 3 years earlier, was front page news across the country, and people were denouncing Dallas from every corner of the country. And everybody in Dallas knew this did not bode well for what was going to happen a few weeks later, because John Kennedy was scheduled to come to town
Let's go back in time. I was sort of charmed by the story about the Christmas card that the Kennedy sent to every big shot in Dallas, mm-hmm. And the reaction, charmed in a kind of a sad way, I suppose, just the reaction to it and how that seemed to galvanize people back then. That was in 1959 or 1960?
Right. It was, yeah, just last week's 1959. It was the Christmas card that went out. Uh-huh.
And that kind of, people were asking each other, why is he sending us a card? Of course, a few weeks later or months later, they knew why, but that sort of got J.L. Hunt all in a lather.
Right. You know, H.L. Hunt, the world's
wealthy, H.L. Hunt, sorry.
Yes, the world's wealthiest man. You know, he had a really unique idea of what America should be. He wanted to rewrite the Constitution. And first of all, at the very top, he wanted to enshrine the oil depletion allowance, this incredibly lucrative tax break that oil producers receive. And he felt certain that John Kennedy would try to take that away from him. But he also believed that wealthy people such as himself should be allowed to buy votes, that he, somebody at his income level should be able to purchase up to 7 votes. And he also felt that those in the bottom 40% of society should get no votes at all. So he was looking for kind of very restricted notion of democracy. He considered America a republic, not a democracy. He actually called it democracy, a watered-down form of communism. So H.L. Hunt, very powerful in Dallas, and as I mentioned a few minutes ago, he had a series of he had a radio program called Lifeline that went out across the country, heard on hundreds of radio stations by millions of listeners every day. And basically, H.L. Hunt turned Lifeline into his own personal anti-Kennedy propaganda machine. And, you know, this is a program telling people Kennedy was going to surrender sovereignty of the U.S. And when John Kennedy proposed this idea of Medicare, H.L. Hunt's announcers went on the air and whipped up hysteria. They told people, their listeners, that Medicare would lead to government death panels, that it would make the president of the United States a medical czar with life or death power over each individual citizen in the country. And so this is a guy who basically, he was very tight-fisted. You know, he drove a very old, beaten-up car. He brought sack lunches to his office. And, you know, he was making $200,000 a day at that time. But he was freely spending his money to try to destroy John Kennedy and to whip up kind of mass hysteria about the idea of someone like Kennedy being in office.
Interesting parallels. Is it just me?
You know, that's one of the most fascinating aspects of our research, Anne, because as we started digging into this story, you know, we knew that Dallas had this reputation for being so anti-Kennedy. And as we started going into the archives and digging up these pieces of information, we were just astounded to find the parallels between 1963 and 2013. You know, not just this opposition to Medicare and calling it death panels, but this whole idea of defining this man as defining John Kennedy as un-American in some way, you know, considering him an enemy of the state. And, you know, people in Dallas were just doing amazing things. You know, they were calling Kennedy a socialist, for example. And you can see in the Dallas Morning News at that time, they kept saying that every proposal Kennedy was coming up with was inspired by the socialists or even the Communist Party. And, you know, for, I don't know how prevalent this is in Ohio, but if you're in Texas, you know, I would drive up to Dallas and do research in archives, and then driving back along Interstate 35, you would see the huge billboard outside of Dallas that had a picture of Obama, and it just said one word under his picture: socialist.
And that was up. That's not very common in Ohio.
Right, and I'll say one other thing too. You know, the day that Kennedy arrived in Dallas, he was greeted by a full-page ad in the Dallas Morning News denouncing him as basically a socialist slash communist. And then there was this flyer. There
right.
were thousands of those flyers.
It's on the cover of the book, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. And these are the flyers that were mocked up to look like a wanted ad. You know, that basically had mugshots of Kennedy on there. And under the mugshots, it says, "Wanted for treason." And, you know, this was kind of the storm that Kennedy was coming into in Dallas.
something about Dallas we kind of touched a little bit on when we were talking about Neiman Marcus, obviously a very expensive store that catered to the very, very wealthy. And we've talked about H.L. Hunt, obviously, well, considered the wealthiest man in the world at the time. There were a lot of really rich people in Dallas.
Yes, and I think that gave Dallas a, you know, and these people were rich for one reason.
Yeah.
It wasn't because they were brilliant.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't that they figured out something. It's that they happened to be sitting next to this huge reservoir of oil that made Texas instantly rich. And, you know, so you had people who were kind of leaping from, you know, the farmhouse or tenement shack into multimillionaire status pretty much overnight. And so these are people who quickly convinced themselves that they had, you know, done it by the dint of hard work and gritty self-determination. And it gave Dallas that feeling of exceptionalism. They believed they were a truly unique place in America, a counterweight to what they saw as the, you know, government meddling and coddling that came from Washington, D.C. And so they sort of became the capital of this resistance movement in America.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We are talking about a book today. It's called Dallas 1963. One of the co-authors is with me, Stephen Davis. He is a scholar of Texas culture and co-author of Dallas 1963. If you have a question or comment for him, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. Carl, you're at the OSU campus. Welcome to the show, Carl.
Good morning. I've got primarily a comment to make about the Eisenhower Archives document 1147 to support what your guest was saying about the crippled culture in Texas. The document 1147 is a letter from President Eisenhower to his brother Edgar. I was looking up a industrial military complex warning. Couldn't find it, but I stumbled on this. In document 1147, Eisenhower tells his brother Edgar that he acknowledges, for example, the overthrow of the government in Iran indirectly in 53. And he goes on to address Edgar's complaints about the Social Security system. And President Eisenhower told his brother that the people opposed to the Social Security system are mainly Texas oilmen, and, quote, they are few in number and they are stupid.
Yeah. And, you know, that mention of Eisenhower, too, one person we haven't talked about who really is at the center of what's going on in Dallas is General Edwin Walker, who was the hero of Little Rock when Eisenhower very reluctantly called in federal troops to integrate Little Rock's Central High School. General Walker from Texas was the man who brought his troops in and did it nearly instantly. Walker later became tangled up with the John Birch Society, which considered Eisenhower a dedicated agent of the communist conspiracy to undermine America. And when that happened, Walker became radicalized as a general. He felt that Eisenhower had used him to further the aims of communism by having him integrate. And when Walker was radicalized, he began doing political proselytizing of his troops. He was a major general, commanded the 24th Infantry Division. When John Kennedy found out about this, he relieved Walker of his command. And General Walker angrily resigned from the military and really received this huge hero's welcome among the far right in America. And he came back to the United States to lead his own campaign against Kennedy. And guess where he chose to live? He was welcomed in Dallas with open arms, greeted by the mayor of the city in a big public ceremony, given a Stetson hat, and thousands of people were cheering him.
Thank you, Carl, for that comment. Let's turn to the African-American community in Dallas and in the area. At the time, there were some people trying to make some changes there and trying to organize people there. Very dangerous.
Absolutely. You know, one of the most interesting people we write about is a woman named Juanita Craft, who really should be a saint. And she is recognized today in Dallas, by the way, as a great hero. Her home has become a museum, and she has a living legacy there. She was the first black woman to cast a vote in Dallas. She worked as a maid at that same hotel where Lyndon and Lady Bird were mobbed. And she she became a leader in the local NAACP during a very dangerous time when black people in Dallas were trying to, basically, they were confined to a very small section of the city. When they began moving into other neighborhoods, their homes were firebombed, and it was very dangerous. She was amazing because Juanita Craft had this wonderful rapport with kids, teenage children, and she brought in hundreds and hundreds of kids into the local NAACP. And working with these kids, these are the people who changed history in Dallas. These kids are the ones who went out onto the front lines during these integration battles. And they did the sit-ins at the drugstores. They did the stand-ins at movie theaters. They boycotted very peacefully in very dignified ways to integrate the state fair, which is held in Dallas every year. And through this force of Juanita Craft, you saw this action happen. And Dallas, which had been resisting integration for so long, suddenly it all the resistance just kind of collapsed when you saw those images of, you know, very well-dressed, very polite, obviously church-going young people, very dignified, demanding equal rights. It changed something in the heart of the city, and the cops didn't harass them like you saw in Alabama and other places. And it was really kind of a beautiful moment, and that was really orchestrated by Juanita Craft.
And what was the timeline of that in relationship to the assassination of Kennedy?
Good question. This actually happened in 1961 in Dallas.
Okay.
The sit-ins were began in Greensboro, North Carolina, as you know, and sort of spread across the country. And that's when Juanita picked them up and brought them to Dallas.
My guest is Stephen Davis, co-author of Dallas 1963. We'll return to our conversation and your comments when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Stephen Davis, co-author of Dallas 1963. If you have a question or comment for Stephen Davis, you can give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Criswell, the Baptist leader there, he was one of the, his congregation was one of the biggest in the country, right?
Yes, absolutely.
The Baptists, although none of them necessarily would say that they oppose integration as well, particularly across the South, but even they were troubled by his brazenness and asked him to cool it.
Not so much at the time. You know,
there was a
rift in the Baptist Church, probably as there was in a lot of churches that had a presence in the South over the issue of integration. And Criswell kind of, you know, put himself at the front of the anti-civil rights parade and waved that banner defiantly. And, you know, he was really emblematic of what you saw happening in the South during this time. My feeling is that we had really a cold civil war taking place in the U.S. You know, the issues of the Civil War had really not been settled as long as there was segregation and Jim Crow and discrimination and lack of employment opportunities for African Americans. And, you know, what's so fascinating about Dallas in 1963 is you had this group of people who wanted to make this cold civil war into a hot war. You know, you had Criswell working with people like General Edwin Walker, who I mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. who led really the worst night of violence the United States had seen since the Civil War between the North and the South. Walker put himself at the head of an anti-integration riot at the University of Mississippi when James Meredith tried to register, and that caused people to die. Dozens of federal marshals were wounded by gunfire. The campus was set ablaze. And Walker was at the head of all of that. And, you know, he was arrested for sedition and insurrection on John Kennedy's personal orders and thrown into a federal psychiatric prison.
Steve in Columbus, you have a question about General Walker and
Yes. Didn't someone try to shoot at General Walker's house a few weeks before the assassination?
Great question, Steve. In fact, General Walker was a high-profile target. He surpassed Stanley Marcus as the most famous man in Dallas. And in April 1963, Lee Harvey Oswald tried to kill General Walker, shot a rifle at General Walker's house, went through the general's window, and it clipped a bit of the crossboard on the screen, and that altered the trajectory of the bullet just enough so that it passed through General Walker's hair instead of lodging into his temple. And it was just part of really this escalating violence you saw in Dallas. You know, Martin Luther King also came to Dallas in early 1963 and was greeted by a very angry crowd, and a bomb threat caused his speech really to be evacuated. It's very difficult times there.
Thanks a lot, Steve, for that call. We appreciate it. Let's talk about Lee Harvey Oswald and his connection to any of this vitriol and or the people like H.L. Hunt and Walker and so forth. There was none, was there?
No, there really wasn't. You know, Oswald was kind of a lone odd duck in Dallas. You know, he was one of the very few overt leftists in the city. And when, you know, he staged a demonstration for the U.S. to keep its hands off Cuba, he was the only person in the demonstration handing out literature. He was really, you know, he was self-identified as a communist. I would say that Oswald's problems transcended his ideology. You know, he was actually terrible at being a communist. He defected to the Soviet Union and couldn't take it, so he came crawling back. He despised people in the working class, which I don't think really any self-respecting communist would do. And he was actually a violent person. You know, he abused his wife. He had this kind of grandiose view of himself. He had higher than average intelligence, and somehow that led him to believe that he deserved a special place in society. And he kept getting frustrated at every turn. You know, everywhere he went, he couldn't find a place to plug himself into. And, you know, people have wondered, is our book saying that this, you know, crazed climate in Dallas, that whipping up this hatred towards Kennedy, did that cause Oswald to shoot the president? Well, of course, none of us can go inside Oswald's mind and determine what his precise motivation was. But I would say that when you have a place where the civic ethos really is calling the president a traitor, saying he should be put to death for treason, and people are repeatedly saying these really kind of violent things aimed at the president. And let me add, too, really quickly, and that when Kennedy was shot in Dallas, before anybody knew, before anybody had been arrested, before anybody knew exactly what had happened, the switchboard at the Dallas Police Department was flooded with phone calls from distraught housewives in Dallas, and they were all calling and sobbing and confessing. Each one was certain that it had been her husband who had killed the president.
Yeah.
And so, you know, my feeling is when you have a climate like that, you know, maybe it did not inspire Oswald necessarily to shoot John F. Kennedy, but sure as hell didn't help, did it?
Yeah, that was a very interesting note in the book, that reaction by the housewives of Dallas. There were other warnings. The Kennedys had been warned repeatedly. There's a letter, a copy of a letter, sent to Pierre Salinger, right? Kennedy's press secretary at the time, telling him, please don't let him come to Dallas.
Right. There were lots of letters like that. We found one from the head of the Democratic Party, a guy named Byron Skelton, who was not that closely connected to John Kennedy, but he was close to Robert Kennedy, and he sent a letter to Bobby basically saying, when you have somebody like General Edwin Walker in Dallas saying that Kennedy is a liability to a free world and whipping up this kind of rhetoric, it's a really dangerous place for the president to come. And Skelton told Bobby, I have this terrible premonition that something terrible will happen to Kennedy if he comes to Dallas. Lots of people had that premonition. There were people, we talked about Adlai Stevenson earlier, he warned John Kennedy to avoid Dallas. Stanley Marcus warned Kennedy to avoid Dallas. A lot of people were very worried that something terrible would happen.
Rick in Akron, you're on the air. Hi, Rick.
How you doing? I'd like to ask the author, with all this anti-sentiment that was going on in Dallas, like last night on PBS, I saw where in the paper they put the route. Why would you advertise the route that he's taken? Why wouldn't you put a bubble or assist a bubble on the back of the car?
It's like there were no preparations taken.
Well, There were. You know, America was a very different place in 1963. Yes, General Walker had been shot at. Yes, there were death threats against the president. But if you think about the way our country was at that time, you know, people have asked, why did John Kennedy even go to Dallas knowing that there was this climate of hatred waiting for him? Well, that's precisely why John Kennedy wanted to go to Dallas. You know, this is a guy who had personal courage, and if he had avoided Dallas, if he had surrendered sovereignty over Dallas to these radicals on the right, including General Walker, he would have not been able to live with himself. And actually, it was General Walker who staged a strategic retreat when Kennedy came. And the fact is that Kennedy and all presidents at that time and some afterwards do public events, and you always balance the risk assessment with accessibility to the crowds. You know, Kennedy had done all kinds of motorcades, and the fact is that when he was in Dallas, you know, you had the largest crowds ever in the history of the city. You had 200,000 people turn out on the streets of Dallas to greet the president, incredibly warm, effusive welcome. These were people who were repudiating the far right, had taken over their city, and they wanted to show the president they either loved him or they respected the office that he held. And his motorcade in Dallas went incredibly well. And that's, you know, something that is a little bit lost to history. And it was really when the motorcade had ended and they were about to get onto the freeway and speed off to lunch, you know, the very last block, basically, just a few spectators left there. That's when he got shot. But, you know, American president in a democracy has to make himself accessible to the people. And they all knew. I mean, there were tens of thousands of windows and skyscrapers overlooking the motorcade route, and there's no way they could check all of them. Mm-hmm. But the Dallas police certainly, working with the Secret Service, you know, were monitoring the far right because they thought that's where the main threats would come from. Mm-hmm. And nobody really paid much attention to this kind of lone leftist drifter who was out there on the other margin.
Thank you, Rick, for that call. Mark in Columbus, you're on the air with author Stephen Davis. Hi, Mark.
Hi there. With your discussion, you've mentioned the sort of the political and social culture of Dallas at the time. And at least today in the world, Austin, which is not too far from Dallas, has like an incredibly opposite culture or politics, at least as it's perceived. And I'm wondering, in Texas at the time, if that's something that you were familiar with, if there had been a dichotomy between Dallas and Austin in the culture. And
yeah, good question, Rick. You know, Austin as a university town and the state capital has always been apart from the rest of the Texas. Austin is also, as some of you may know, really the most pleasant part of Texas. It's certainly very pretty in Austin with trees and hills and clear flowing streams. And it's kind of a place where people in Texas have always liked to come. And the universities, you know, generated generations of free thinkers, basically. And the politicians come in there and get kind of seduced by the environment. But at that time, the distinctions between Austin and the rest of Texas weren't really that pronounced. They've become more so as the years have passed, and Austin's developed this great live music scene and it's become kind of a center for a lot of authors and media and film production, too.
Mark, thanks a lot for your call. Let's talk a little bit about the journalism of Dallas. The publisher of the Dallas Morning News, you mentioned the biggest paper in town, the biggest paper in the state, right? He'd inherited the business from his father. He really embraced those editorial pages in a way his father had not. It was his kind of, the timing of that was critical, too.
Yes. Ted Dealey, Dealey Plaza's name for his father. Mm-hmm. His father was known as being a very fair and balanced publisher. Ted Dealey basically became more and more extreme as he got older. And he's the guy who hated John Kennedy so much, he accepted an invitation to visit Kennedy in the White House as part of a social luncheon for publishers. And at that luncheon, got in Kennedy's face and told the president, America needs a man on horseback to lead this country. And too many of us in Texas and the Southwest think you're riding Caroline's tricycle. And he was calling Kennedy essentially a weakling because he wanted Kennedy to launch a first strike nuclear war against the Soviet Union, a view, by the way, that was shared among Kennedy's top military command. They knew that the U.S. had military advantage over Russia when it came to nuclear arms and wanted to take advantage of it. So Ted Dealey, you know, generated, again, another person from Dallas, generating these unfortunate headlines coast to coast, this boorish man. And it was Dealey who, you know, I mentioned 200,000 people in Dallas turned out to greet Kennedy. Really, there was a lot of civic love, and people were trying to repudiate what the far right had been doing. Well, Ted Dealey was kind of one of the notable exceptions there. He personally approved a full-page ad in his newspaper that mockingly said, "Welcome, Mr. Kennedy, to Dallas," and basically outlined that Dallas was a super patriot city and John F. Kennedy was a sniveling communist sympathizer. And this was the advertisement that Kennedy saw that morning on November 22nd when he turned to his wife and said, "We're heading into nut country today."
You told someone that the assassination is in the marrow of the city, its DNA, that it's never gone away. How did the city deal with it then, and how does it deal with it now?
Yeah, that's a really good question, Ann. Dallas, you know, it's a place that's always been kind of insecure and, you know, built up a lot of pride because of its wealth and sort of tolerated these extremists on the far right. And then with the shame of the presidential assassination, because as we talked about the black smears against Dallas earlier, that basically served to finally, once and for all, define the city negatively in the eyes of the rest of the world. And the people in Dallas were just ashamed for years. They wanted to obliterate really any trace that the assassination had happened in their city. They railed out against being defined in that way. You know, the mayor of Dallas, who welcomed General Walker, said afterwards, "This assassination could have happened in Podunk as well as Dallas." But it became a very difficult civic issue. And there was a move, actually, to tear down the school book depository building where Oswald had fired his shots from. And, you know, the stigma really lasted for a long time. It helped a bit with the Dallas Cowboys becoming popular, and then that TV show Dallas that became worldwide popular sort of helped blur the image of Dallas in some ways. But really what happened in Dallas is in late 1980s, enough time had gone by. Some of the old guard was dying out and younger generations were coming into power, more diverse generations. You know, Dallas has had an African-American mayor who's very successful. Their current sheriff is Hispanic and also lesbian. They've become quite a different place than they were in 1963. And actually, other than Austin, Dallas itself has had the highest percentage of vote for Barack Obama when he ran for president. So it's kind of a progressive city in Texas now, although many of the arch conservatives have moved out into the suburbs. So there's still a pretty large conservative segment of society there. But what rescued Dallas, I think, really rescued, helped heal itself, is saving that building that was going to be torn down, turning it into what's called the Sixth Floor Museum on Dealey Plaza. And this is as dignified and honorable of a memorial as you can have to President John Kennedy and his legacy. It is, I'm sure, one of the leading tourist attractions in the state of Texas, if not one of the very top. Brings in people from all over the world who, you know, kind of come to see where Kennedy's life ended, but then they learn a lot about what things were like at that time in Dallas and what really, you know, they learn to honor Kennedy's presidency in a more dignified way than, you know, might otherwise happen.
They came to own what happened.
I don't know if I'd go that far, Ann.
Okay. All right.
there's still
a little bit of denial going on.
There's still, yes. Okay. Maybe even a lot of denial, perhaps.
Well, Steve Davis, thanks so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it. I've enjoyed it very much.
Well, it was great to talk to you, Ann. Thanks so much.
Stephen Davis, he is curator at the Whitliff Collections at Texas State University in San Marcos and a leading scholar of Texas culture. He is a co-author with Bill Minutaglio of the new book, Dallas 1963. Thanks so much for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.